You be my bunny, and I'll be your Clyde. Bury our future, and together we'll ride.
You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. My guest for episode 80 will be Rod Peacock, who started playing around Nashville in 1994, had some success writing for other artists, and has released 10 albums of his own music since 2001. We're going to be largely focusing today on his latest, a double album, Out Past the Wires, that includes an accompanying book of short stories. And you are right now listening to the opening track of that, Be My Bonnie. The two we're going to discuss in depth from that album are Take Home Pay and Date of Grace. Then we're going to turn back to the album Welding Burns from 2011. The song is Rust Belt Fields. And we'll conclude by listening to a song called You're Not Missing Anything from the 2014 album Hang Your Hopes on a Crooked Nail. For more information, visit rodpeacock.com. For more information about this podcast, please visit nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you like what we're doing here, I encourage you to contribute at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will have played some of Be My Bonnie, the opening track to the new album, Out Past the Wires. And I have the accompanying book that I have read, although that song is not, there's not a story equivalent on it. We are going to get to Take Home Pay, the first one, which does have both the story and the song. Say something about putting those out together and what that whole project's about.
Yeah, well, it was very organic. I love sort of narrative songs where there's a story and characters, and that's always been something that I've been drawn to even when I was a kid. So pairing the two things together was very organic and simple. The songs informed me which stories wanted to be written and which songs felt like they had characters that could be expanded upon. You know, obviously, if you're writing in the first person, it's not quite as simple. But if you have characters outside of yourself and a narrative quality to the song, there's sort of a natural compatibility there.
Sure. Well, how about this song in particular? Just give us a little introduction, then we'll play it in full, and then we'll talk in depth about it. Take Home Pay.
Take Home Pay. It was written with my longtime co-writing partner, Slade Cleaves. We've written a lot of songs together over the years. I was a sheetrock hanger. I was worked in construction till I was about 36, 37, till the first record came out, and I was able to build a little touring bass. I got out of the trades just in time, and my body really started breaking down. And the story of the character in the song of Take Home Pay is a guy who didn't get out quite in time, and he's trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life or how he's going to make it, you know, after his body starts breaking down. And obviously the economics of working in that environment have changed over the years too. So that's part of it. So it's sort of slightly political with a small p.
My shoulder burns like a grinding gearbox. These young crews are too fast and tough. I'm on my way down to the pawn shop. A couple hundred is all I need. If I have to, I'll hit the blood bank. I'm bone dry, but I can always bleed. Schemers scheme around the edges. Dreamers dream a better. Catches. It's all about the take-home pay. Got some oxy to keep me moving. Slowly take some things away. The only thing I was scared of losing, she's already long gone away. I guess she got tired of waiting for the man she thought I'd. In the end, you can't really blame her. We're all scratching for the do-re-mi. Schemers scheme around the edges. Dreamers dream of better days. But everyone knows what the catch is. It's all about the take-home.
to the red-eyed truckers coming in off the interstate. We'll take a job down at the Home Depot. It's half the pay, but it'd still get by. There's a new girl working the checkout. I think I caught her giving me the eye. Schemers scheme around the edges. Dreamers dream of better days. But everyone knows what the catch is. It's all about the take-home pay. Schemers scheme around the edges. Dreamers dream of better days. But everyone knows what the catch is. It's all about the take-home. It's all about the take-home pay.
The difference between telling a story in a song and telling a story in prose, you could have a lot more moves in prose. That even the most story-like songs seem like they're more like snapshots. They're expressing something coherent, and so in that sense, they're a story. In this song, something does happen in the latter part of it. You know, it's not just a snapshot of how poor the guy is and how economically bad, you know, that we at least have his reaction to it. Although, so it almost looks like it's still a snapshot, but it's kind of a widescreen, and then we zoom in on this particular character's reaction to it, as opposed to the story where, you know, there's actually a sequence of events.
They're very different. I mean, you know, some of the songs are closer tied than others. Some of the songs just had a title that lent itself, or a sort of concept that lent itself to expanding on a character. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't even feel like they're about the same people. I just thought it was sort of interesting and clever to use the titles. A song has to be very tight in order for it to work. A song can be expansive. It can cover a lot of philosophical area. But you're right, there aren't that many places to make moves. You know, most songs have, what, three verses of four lines each or eight lines each. So you've got 12 or 24 lines to tell the entire story. And sometimes that's not enough. Most of the time it is, depending on how you craft it. But sometimes it's not enough. Sometimes there's something more interesting that requires digging in a little bit further. That was sort of my natural progression to the short stories.
I guess the sort of dramatic move here. So I noticed in listening, and I'll link folks to Slade Cleaves' version of it that he released on his album in 2017, that you've got obvious differences in the arrangement. It's a different key, just a different feel overall. The main riff, you've got your nice little Beatles-y da 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 da. The arrangement, I mean, is that a matter of the producer that you were working with and the band that came together, and so those kind of licks were just something that would come out in the recording, and you just come to it with your guitar and your voice, and that's the song? Or do you have that intro riff as sort of part of the official song when you're writing it?
No, I mean, you can tell on my records, you can tell when the riff is mine because I'm playing it on the acoustic guitar. It's built into the song, you know, so I just came in with the chords and the melody and the lyric. And, you know, Slade went to his producer with the chords, melody, and lyric. That's what each of us had. And so his producer has laid out his version, you know, differently than mine. And yeah, that's just a function of the producer, you know. Production is a funny thing with a record. I mean, everybody produces a record. Everybody that's in the room really is producing the record. I mean, the drummer is making choices about which pieces of his kit to use and which snare drum. And it's not like the old days where the producer was writing the arrangement and writing the string arrangement and, you know, picking the key and everything. It's not usually like that anymore. The producer is more generally kind of directing the session, maybe commenting on tempo or maybe key and things like that. But he's not usually writing parts for people. Unless, say, the guitar player plays something that stands out as being particularly good, he might say, oh, grab that there, do that again, make that the riff, you know, or something like that. And so, yeah, the two versions they feel quite different, yeah.
So this is Nilsen Hubbard, the producer. So this band, was that sort of his house band or something that came together for this recording, or are these folks that you were already playing with in other live performance?
A couple of them are people I've used on other records and I specifically asked for, but basically Nielsen put the band together for the record, yeah. You know, there's a big crossover. We both live in Nashville, so it's not like I didn't know who these guys were, but we discussed, you know, who we wanted to have for the band, and we absolutely wanted Lex Price on bass, and we wanted Will Kimbrough to come in and do guitars, And the drummer, you know, we had a few different drummers. We ended up with Evan Hutchings, great drummer who has a really wide scope of what he can do, which is what we needed for this record because it's so wide, you know, 22 songs.
Will's doing all the electric parts here. It's because I noticed they're more than one at a time. This was not a live guitarist, electric guitarist reacting to each other. This was layered.
Some of them are and some of them aren't. Some of them, it's the first or second take of the band playing to me. But the band was all together at the same time. Occasionally, we asked Will to take another pass at it if we wanted to fill it out a little bit more or something like that. Chris Donegan was the other guitar player. So we had Will for 2 days and we had Chris Donegan for 1 day.
For a double album, 3 days total of guitarists.
Nielsen and I have stumbled on a really interesting way to make a record, which is that I do all of my stuff first. So I go in and get great live takes of just me and the guitar.
Are you doing using a click track?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends on how I'm reacting to the pace of the song. If it feels like I'm nailing it, then we lose the click track. If it feels unnatural, if I'm finger picking, we usually lose the click track because I have a very good right hand for finger picking. I can almost come back to a track. You could put me halfway in it and I could pick up and keep the same pace and it would be in the same time at the end of the song. Strumming, I'm a little wild and woolly when it comes to strumming, so sometimes we use the click on the strumming.
Not a lot of drummers like to put up, at least my experience, with here's a free take I did, go put full drum kit over it. If they're just doing little fills or something, like, that's fine, but to actually, no. I've sent tracks to somebody and just have them sent back. You know, I just went ahead and re-recorded the chord progression because what you sent me was unusable. Like, okay.
What you end up doing is, like, if I'm strumming along and I'm strumming to a click track and we're doing my live take, then we take that click track away. I've got a great take that's in tune and in time from beginning to end. It might not be perfect. I might wander a little bit, but it's going to end in the same, at the same tempo as it starts. And so that's the most important thing. And then we'll give that to the drummer will be playing to that, but the drummer won't be using a click. He'll be playing to me singing and playing in time. So what you end up with is this sort of lovely in-between sort of space between playing completely live, which is really hairy. It's a really hairy thing to do. You can do it and people do it and it can come out great. But you're stuck with what you get that day. And we've made a record that way. We made a record called Fortune that way. And it is a hairy record. But doing it this way, the way that I'm describing, you get a complete band playing live and inspired to me playing at my very best. So they're playing to a great a track that sounds great already, that's in tune and in time. And they're playing as if I'm singing my best over and over, no matter how many times they have to sort of wander through it to get a good arrangement of it. It's a compromise that gives you this beautiful sort of in-between.
You're playing guitar acoustic and singing at the same time, so then you can't fix the pitch, say, just on the voice, because you're going to have bleed between the microphones. You could take the whole thing, and do you know if he, like, any digital timing fixes of just, you know, if we just had that one entrance to verse 3 a quarter second later, then it would actually line up with what the drummer ended up doing.
No, we don't do any of that. That's what keeps it feeling very lively, you know? That's what keeps it feeling very human. And, you know, I have a theory about recording that, you know, every step that you take away from the actual moment of a human making music with an instrument, it leads you down this path that doesn't give you something that's, you know, it removes the humanity from it. And so, you know, recording digital, it's the way it's done these days. I mean, you can record analog. It's a lot of work. It's incredibly expensive. So there's one step. The second step is if you start pitch correcting things, you're taking another step away from the humanity of it. If you quantize the beat or the drums, you've taken another step. So every one of those steps that you take away removes some of the humanity of the thing. And so, you know, I'm willing to go so far so that I'm able to make records. You know, I'm willing to record digitally, but I'm not really willing to go much past that. I love the rawness of records. I mean, you can't beat those early Stones records. I mean, you know, those old Little Willie John recordings. You can't beat what it sounds like for a human to really put themselves out there and to give their best performance. You can't fix that. You can't repeat that. You can't make that up. You can make a version of it, but you're not going to capture the humanity of it.
So it seems like one of the ways that, you know, you've got a double album worth of songs that all have you doing rhythm acoustic guitar, which sometimes you're doing steel strings, sometimes you're doing nylon. Is that right?
It's all the Gibson J45 on this record, on the new record.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a picture of you on your website, and there's a nylon next to you. So that's what I was reacting to. Or it looks like it anyway, unless I'm...
That's from the recording of Fortune, where I used a nylon string across the whole record, yeah.
But in order to make that sound a little different from song to song, I think a lot of it goes into the mix, so that, you know, some of them are completely drum-free, some of them... And this one, your rhythm guitar, even if that's the thing that was driving, that they were all playing to, it's almost subliminal. Like, once the tambourine comes in parts, like, I don't even hear it anymore. So it's really, it comes in and out based on whether everything else is out of the way or not. Even though it's, you know, a constant presence through the song from the beginning, it's just not even something I noticed right away.
Well, it's depending on the song, yeah. I mean, there's a wide scope on this record, though. So, you know, I mean, there's a couple tracks that are just me and the guitar.
Yeah, no, I would say that's an easy way to have enough variation to keep the record sounding interesting, is just mess with the mix a little bit.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, it depends on what your tastes are as a listener. I mean, I could listen to John Prine just sing and play guitar with absolutely no backing for hours, you know, and I would find that endlessly entertaining because he's such a master at sort of, he's such a master songwriter and, you know, digging around and finding odd angles to look at things, you know.
And that's still your main live gig, right? Is still solo? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Given the emphasis on lyrics, I mean, if you want to tell the story, having a drummer banging behind you that you can't mix down doesn't help matters, certainly. Yeah, one of the things I noticed, the difference between yours and Slade Cleaves' version, is the last two verses are swapped, just that for you, it's, you could be set up at the Super 8 selling pills to truckers, or I guess I could go to the Home Depot. So like the Home Depot is sort of the worst possible thing in the arc here, getting half the pay, whereas the way that he presents it is the Home Depot, you know, I could do the straight thing or I could pursue the criminal life. I don't know. I saw something, a difference in story in just that choice to swap that.
Slade never worked in construction, so.
Makes sense.
We have a different angle on that. And he was afraid of the word speed. You know, I use the word speed and he used the word pills. You know, I tend to like things a little bit harder edged than Slade does. And he tends to like things a little bit neater and a little bit more elegant than I do. I don't mind the sort of the hairy truth of the thing as much as he does. But we have a gentleman's agreement. I mean, when we write together, we bring a song to the kind of 95% point. And then if we have some disagreement about a word or two or a line or two, we just sort of allow each other to separate and just say we've got a song. You know, some we argue more about than others. Some we fight tooth and nail over. And some we have a quick parting of the ways, sort of you like it that way and I like it this way. And so we're going to part ways and you go right ahead and I'll go right ahead.
Record your own versions of it that are slightly different. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of fun too. Cause you know, sometimes he comes out with the song before I do. Sometimes I come out with the song before he does. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, I think to both of us, it's interesting to see what the other guy does with it. So, you know, there are times when I think, I got him on that one. And other times I think, you know, he got me on this one. So, you know, it's interesting.
Well, let's get our second song on the table, which is Date of Grace, which is a solo composition. And there's no drums in this one. This really is emphasizing your finger picking. However, we have pretty prominent strings in here, which I assume is a totally different element than when you're doing with the guitars and bass and drums.
The song seemed ripe for strings to me. And for a long time, I worked with a guy named David Henry, who's a wonderful cellist and arranger. And he's kind of a one-man string section. You know, he can imitate a violin by where he plays on the cello, and he can do the bass section by where he plays on the cello, and he kind of does the whole thing on a cello. He's just wonderfully talented, and I felt like the lyric was calling for that sort of softer element. In order to get the recording, see, now when I play live, I can do that by my expression, and I can do that with sort of how I approach the lyric as they lay the lyric out. But on the recording, I felt like we wanted to have that element of the kind of rise and fall of the song. And I felt like strings were the appropriate element for this particular song because it was such a gentle melancholy. And yeah, I think it works well.
Lift
at me like I was weightless. Then you let me fall back down again. It's all right, we fly the best we can, and I know your wings were broken. I dusted off my blue shirt and poured some whiskey where it hurt. Picked the pieces out of the dirt and kept them as a token. And there ain't nothing left to do when your deed of grace is due. Remember all the nights we laid across your sheets of serenade. From the sky, the stars all played back then. They all hung for you. Back then, I was just a kid trying to walk like I thought grown men did. Too thin to hide what I needed hid, so I kept my heart from you. There ain't nothing left to say. It don't matter now anyway. There ain't nothing left to do when your date of grace is due. I must think about you and the love that could not pull us through. We're tying stones to the devil's shoes, just trying to slow his dance down. Burned your letters on the lawn while I was working on a song. The tune was good, but the words were wrong. I never found the right ones. There ain't nothing left to say. It don't matter now anyway. There ain't nothing left to do when your date of grace is due. When your date of grace is due. Know my lies from truth. He dusted my heart looking for proof. All you found was the wisdom tooth I lost along the way.
So this one, I think the most useful thing to focus on here is the melody. I mean, the whole thing, it's sold by the melody. It's just this nice kind of lullaby sort of thing. Yes, having the breathing, the sort of pulsing of the strings and that stuff is great. But this, you know, is obviously one that works just fine as a solo thing. Doesn't require a lot of dynamics in terms of, you can always take a ballad and put in lap steel or something like that to do other little tinkly things. But other than the strings, you know, it's really just the pushing your voice to different degrees. Your voice is hard to nail down from record to record and from song to song, that it sort of has different, okay, that there it's a little more Kris Kristofferson, there it's a little more Johnny Cash, there it's a little, like if I played some of them, I wouldn't even necessarily know it was the same person singing. And in this one, you definitely, just even between the verse and the chorus, it kind of goes from the more quiet speaking to the now I'm singing, you know, a little more dramatic, I say.
My voice works in a particular kind of way. It took me a long time to learn how to use it expressively. And also it took me a long time to find the confidence in my voice and what it can do. In a way, it's sort of acting when you're singing. You know, you're acting with the tone and inflection of your voice, of what you're communicating. I don't mean in a theater sense. I mean, actually the opposite than sort of theater singing, which is operatic and big and meant to hit the back row. What I do is exactly the opposite of that. There's quite a dynamic range that I use when I'm singing, sometimes even within one song. just like you said, between the going from the verses to the chorus there. Part of that is where the key is. My voice has a certain depth to it in the key that we stuck this song in, which I think is, let's see, we're tuned down. So it's an F, I think.
You're playing drop D there? I hear, you know, low D on everything.
We're a whole step down. I tuned down a whole step. I've lost a couple of notes off the top of my voice over the last few years. So I just keep tuning down to accommodate it. So I'm tuned down a whole step there. And I think I'm playing in the G forms that would put it in F, I guess. Unless I went down a step and a half.
These were straight enough progressions. I actually got my guitar out and was like, okay, what's that? That's
yeah, it's just 1, 5, 6, 4. Yeah, pretty much through the whole thing. I think it's one of the better lyrics on the record, not in terms of a narrative, but in terms of a marriage of detail, a marriage of prose and prosaic, you know. There are some lines in there that I suppose that's why I picked it when you asked to pick out the two songs. There's a narrative element to it. It doesn't move very far, but yeah, I like the marriage of prosaic and poetic in the song. It's a song that's very moving to play live. It's been interesting because you never really know with a song until you get it in front of a group of people how the audience is going to react to it. A lot of times you record a song before you even played it live. It's not always the case. You know, a lot of the songs, I mean, there were 22 songs here. So a lot of these songs that was playing for months before we went in to record them. So I was very, very comfortable with them. Others, I hadn't played at all in front of people. And so it's a kind of exciting, nerve wracking little mystery to see how the audience is going to react. And also how you're as a performer, how you're going to paint that song live. Date of Grace has been a really interesting one. It has a really powerful audience reaction. It's a funny thing. There's something wrong with any of us that wants to do this for a living. it's a crazy thing to want to do, to stand in front of people, physically stand there in front of them, perform your art in the moment, and then ask them to either give the thumbs up or the thumbs down. There's something mentally wrong with any... with every singer-songwriter who wants to get on stage, I think.
I think the thing that makes it a little easier is just the fact that the raw sound of nice chord progression, there's a reason that you're sticking to, you know, fairly straight ahead chord progressions and not feeling the need to, like, I need to put in a ninth there to differentiate it from other things I've heard. You know, especially with the acoustic guitar, it's just such a pretty sound in itself. You know, you could just go out and play that for people. There's a certain amount of goodwill just out of that. So whatever you can put on top of that in terms of telling the story and varying your voice in a dramatic way and how you're doing the vocal rhythms and stuff, that's almost bonus. It's a different set of norms in the more rockin' things that you've got, you know, in the first song, the slightly more Beatles thing with a little catchy beat to it, that even that's why I always feel like it's fairly rare among singer-songwriters or I guess among musicians in general, I should say, for as much emphasis to go on the lyrics as you have, you know, that you could take any of these and make them into stories, because I almost feel like the lyrics are, in the nature of the performance situation, almost optional. It's a genre unto itself to actually have sort of literary-based. It seems like a lot of the country singer-songwriters that you were citing its influences had that focus, like Townes Van Zandt or whatever, on lyrics as well.
Well, here's what I think about that. What you just said is, I think that this thing that I do, you come to it from one of two angles. You're either a musician who learns how to write songs because you're a musician and you love music. You learn how to write songs so that you have songs to play because you're a musician. Or you're a writer and you write songs. You learn to play an instrument to perform what it is that you write. Those are two very different things. That explains the interesting phenomenon of why, like, you can hear somebody like John Prine, who's particularly these days not in great singing form, but you can listen to him and it doesn't even occur to you that he's not a great singer. He's a fantastic singer. Because what he's doing is telling you stories. He's a storyteller. He's an amazing writer. And that's what he's doing. So it doesn't really make any difference, you know, what his voice sounds like. If he's croaking along, it still sounds amazing. Because that's not really what he's trying to do for you. So he's not failing at the thing that he's trying to do for you. He's giving you an A+ at the thing that he's trying to do for you. As opposed to the other way, where if you have a great singer who can really wail, I mean, you see it on the TV in all these contest shows. You hear singer after singer who have amazing chops, but none of the song comes across. Nothing of it. There's no feeling. It's just athletic to them. You know, they're hitting the notes, they're nailing the notes, they're squeezing all the drama out of the notes. But still, the song isn't coming through because it's meaningless to them. The words that they're singing are meaningless. They're singers, they're performers. The lyric doesn't mean anything to them. And so it explains that sort of odd thing that happens, you know, when you can hear Townes Van Zandt will bring you to tears with something. He can barely sing, you know, so on some of those recordings, he's barely singing. You know, Guy Clark had a range of about, you know, less than an octave. So he's not an amazing singer. And yet what he's able to communicate with his voice is coming from a writer's point of view. And so that's what he's bringing you. That's the important part of what he's bringing you.
It's still a little different between a straight up poet who might even be doing actual talk singing. Like there's no actual singing. It's kind of doing the same thing that you're doing in terms of, you know, have a structured thing, is telling a story and the focus is on the lyrics, but doesn't necessarily have that nice conventional blanket of sound. The acoustic guitar with its beautiful tone, or you could do piano, the same thing, and those kind of chords. It's a difference between what you're doing is very artistic, but nobody's going to call you art rock, as in hard to listen to. It's a nice coupling that the music that you're into is also very pleasing to give a basic set piece for these stories you're telling. Laurie Anderson or something is what I was thinking of, or something like somebody like that. That's kind of hard to get a handle on.
A great example of, I guess, of what you're talking about is like the last couple Leonard Cohen records where he's really not singing at all. I mean, he's really just kind of croaking along. He's kind of sometimes indicating melody, but not much. He doesn't have much left. He's got about five notes there. And yet some of them are set in this beautiful musical setting. And you know, music is such a strange and complicated thing. You think, how can that work? But the dichotomy of the roughness and the ravaged quality of his voice against that beautiful music is, it's incredibly moving. I mean, sometimes you don't know exactly why something works, but it does, you know, because it just depends on what you're looking for. I mean, people are looking for different things with music.
So just looking back to Data Grace in particular, so you got phrasing like, lifted me like I was weightless, then you let me fall back down, which is a lot of syllables for that little bit. Like the verses, you know, it does, I wouldn't say musical theater, but does that mean that the lyrics were written first and that you're kind of shoving them in? Because if you just wrote a lullaby from scratch, there's no way there would be that many words like in that first line. It would be just a more...
Remember how slow the song is too. So it's sort of paced out. I mean, the way that you read it just there, it sounds kind of jumbled, but it's mm-hmm. paced very, very slowly. You know, it's, you lifted me like I was weightless, then you let me fall back down again. So the pace of it makes those syllables work. You couldn't do it much faster than that, that's for sure. So you're on to something there. I always think the best songs, for the most part, come with a piece of melody, a piece of lyric, and a piece of chord progression at the same time. There's something so natural about those songs that is a bit different than something that's crafted. I mean, I've been writing songs since I was 16 years old. I probably didn't write a good song till I was 30 years old. But you recognize something in a song that a natural quality that's, it's hard to describe, from something that's a piece of work that's all tools that you've sort of chiseled out. For me, that's what I'm looking for when I'm writing. I'm looking for capturing that little spark, that little piece of lightning, even if it's just two lines, you know, and a little piece of melody.
Well, yeah, the first chorus. Yeah, I know it's slow, but like that's a damn short first chorus. That's just one line or two short lines.
Yeah, it's just two lines. The song is, it's not incredibly long, but it's
342.
It's only 342, really? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't even realize that. The pace of the song is so slow that I didn't want to hit that full chorus three times. I wanted to hit half the chorus the first time we hit the chorus and then hit the full chorus the second two times, just so that it tickles the listener's ear a little bit. Keeping in mind that, did you ever see Dick Cavett did those interviews and compiled them into a DVD or somebody compiled them into a DVD collection. And there's one with Paul Simon where he talks about how he doesn't repeat things exactly the same way. So as he goes through a song, there might be the same chords in the second chorus, but he'll play them in a different position. Or he'll play the last line of the chorus twice the second time through. And then when he goes to the verse, he'll do an inversion of the chord or do something to it to kind of just constantly be tickling your ear so that something new is happening all the time.
But then you can't digitally copy and paste the entire chorus over to the...
Can't do it, no. But it's a wonderful, I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be a rule, you know, and I didn't take it as that. I just thought it was a wonderful concept to add to my palette as a songwriter, just to keep that in mind. Lucinda Williams is another wonderful songwriter who does the same thing. She'll do these odd little things like, you know, she'll let the drums do two measures after the first chorus and then four measures after the second chorus. If you listen to a song like Too Cool to Be Forgotten, you know, the way it's laid out is very, very interesting. It keeps changing. As it goes through the song, it keeps changing how many measures that drummer plays before the band comes in and how many times that guitar does that lick. You know, da 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 da. It does work. It tickles your ear. It keeps you interested. You never know quite where she's going to come back in.
I hadn't noticed you doing any. Maybe it's just because, you know, you tend to have fairly relaxed or self-confident sort of songs. A lot of times I'll add just an extra half a measure or something, add a couple beats or add something to, but that works better when the song is just supposed to be in some way kind of jerky and nervous. And I don't feel like that is your natural palette.
No, I'm doing it in a different way. I mean, I'm doing it sheerly out of keeping the audience's ear, keeping the listener's ear. And I don't do it a lot, but I do tend to do it on songs where I feel like there's not a wide scope in the melody, or, you know, maybe the melody is fairly limited or some element of the song is kind of limited. That's where I look for to use those kinds of little tricks.
Sure. Especially, yeah, if you're playing by yourself, it's got to be those kind of variations as opposed to, I mean, of course, both these songs that we played do have that kind of variation in the arrangement as well. That the way that the strings come in, the chorus, it's just a single note that eventually resolves the, okay, it's an actual riff. It's not just we're going to have strings to come in to play one note and go away. But that it seems right until the end that that's actually what's going to happen. And then you've got a while before you've got him, it's in the right ear. And then during the next verse, then he comes in the left ear. Now that you're telling me that this is all cello, I actually really do like the sound. I was thinking it was viola at first because I really do like the sound of strings that don't have the super high violin. That's a different palette that can approach disco, you know, a summer place, the kind of, but if it's all very low, kind of locked in with your vocal range, it's nice. And then when he comes in where it's layered four or five of them, it's not until very far into the song, it's super effective that without even having those extra high notes to draw on, it still sounds very wide.
Yeah, that was intentional too, because he sent a couple different versions over and I made one request, which was that I wanted it to build and I wanted it to wait before it came in. I wanted it to come in small and I wanted it to finish bigger. And so that's the way we mixed it. He's got great instincts for that kind of stuff. And we worked well together for a lot of years till he decided to leave the business. So we had a very instinctive way of working together. It's just a wonderful player. You know, Nashville is, it's a cliche, but Nashville is an embarrassment of riches. When it comes to players, it's just really unbelievable. Your cab driver might be one of the best bass players in town.
Well, I was in Austin for 6 years, so I'll fight for that. I'm sure it's not the same level, but I certainly was running into the same. Yeah, everybody's a musician somewhere. Well, before we move on to the third song, so just the phrase that's the capper of the song, when your date of grace is due, can you kind of give us the, how would you come up with that? That's not a normal phrase. I think I know what it means.
It's a term that pawn shops use for when your beloved guitar that you've brought in to get some cash comes due. That's the date of grace where you need to either pay for it or they own it.
Let's get the third one out there. So Rust Belt Fields, we're looking back to Welding Burns, 2011. Your voice sounds quite different on this one. I don't know if it's just the time passing or your development of your style. Do you want to say something about sort of where you were at this point with this project, how your songwriting has changed between what you're doing now and what you're doing here? It's still very story-oriented. It's still very vivid. This could very easily be made into a short story just as much as either the other ones that we've talked about.
This is another one written with Slade Cleaves. When I play this song, I'm struck by how you have to have faith in your audience, you know, because there are a few lines that that sound sort of vaguely political and paint the character of the song, if you don't have an open enough mind, could paint the character inside the song as a certain kind of guy that, depending on your politics, could be an unappealing guy. But you have to have faith in your audience. If you're writing about a character, you can't allow him to be somebody he's not. You have to follow the entire thing through, and you have to make sure that the language that you're using and that he's using inside the song is his natural language. What part of the country is he from? What is he dressed in? You have to picture him. You have to be vigilant about that stuff, or it doesn't ring true. It's interesting. And you have to do that investigation yourself. It's not something you can shop out to somebody else, and it's not something that you can be lazy on. It's a very narrative song. The guy is talking to you, the character is talking to you, and he's just telling you his story. And this particular character's story speaks to a lot of different parts of the country, where that part of the country was built on a particular industry, and that industry is going or gone away. And so what do the people who live there do? If you're tied to that place, and that's your home, what decisions do you make? What do you do with that question when the industry that built that area and that made that community is no longer viable or isn't there anymore? That's an important question, I think, to ask. I don't think it's asked often enough. It's part of the problem that we're having politically right now. You have people during the election talking about how they were going to bring coal back. Well, coal's not coming back, and it's not because it's not there. It's for a lot, the coal jobs are not coming back. Have you ever seen a longwaller mining machine? They're absolutely enormous. It replaces hundreds of men, literally hundreds of men. It erects beams underneath itself as it moves through the seam of coal. Like, there's a machine that's where the jobs are. So if coal did come back, that's who's doing the coal. It's two guys with remote controls tearing through the mountain with the longwaller. It's not 600 guys going in there with helmets and shovels. And so Rust Belt Fields is, while it's not about that particular industry, it's a similar story. It's a character wondering what he's going to do now that what he's built his life on has gone out from underneath him.
This is my town, out in the Rust Belt Fields. We were banging out Buicks and Oldsmobiles. There was always a job, and the money was there. Some say we got a little lazy, no one seemed to care. But they figured it out, shipped the elbow grease down to Mexico, off to the Chinese. Well, I learned a little something about how things are. No one remembers your name just for working hard. Covered into the ground till the factory's cold, and they tear it all down and the parts get sold. Come the lawyers now, picking over the bones, and the street is just ghosts where they used to be home. They figured it out, shipped the elbow grease down to Mexico, off to the Chinese. I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. Remembers your name just for working hard. casino boat up around Boone. Think I'll buy me a bottle and a motel room and put all I have left on a little black square. Risk it all like the big boys, like I don't even care. Drive you into the ground till your engine's cold, calling the auctioneers as the bank's foreclosed. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. No one remembers your name just for working hard.
Yeah, so the fact that you started telling the story of basically the song Coal and the story that it depicts one of the machines that you're talking about, which you just... You know, this is obviously a theme that you've been concerned with for a while here. A lot of your stories have a stinger, that it's painting a sort of snapshot of the person's life and describing. And then in the last little bit, it's like, well, what happens as a result of that? And it's something horrible, or it's seldom a happy ending. Well, we have that in this song here. We have the nice, this is what I was specifically thinking of, that you've got your wide angle picture of, it's a little weird. And maybe this is what you were talking about, of having a view of what you think the narrator's like, but I guess I'm not used to people talking about a social issue this way in such a lament. But by the time you get to verse 3, and you can see what point of view this is actually coming from, that this is just as much as, you know, like one of your songs, like Bottom of the Well, all these several songs of just somebody who's just about to basically leaving Las Vegas, drinking themselves to death or some very self-destructive thing, that once you get to the end of this song, like, oh, that actually then makes the tone make absolute sense for the whole thing. If it was really just exactly this tone, but you stopped before you got to that last thing, then I think you could be accused of, you know, is this an overwrought political statement or something? But it, as a character thing, it absolutely makes sense.
Ah, that's the trick. When you have a point of view that you want to express, that's one of the basic tenets of good writing, is you don't tell people what they're supposed to get from your writing. You lead them to it gently. And I think that that's what makes more effective writing. It also releases you as the writer from the song a bit. It's the character telling his story. And so it's just his story. It's in his words. And you have to be careful not to step outside of that and make it political with a big P. This is just his story, you know? It's a simple story and it's common. But I think the trick is to make it vivid and believable and to make the audience care about the character. There are tricky elements to writing about these things, that there are landmines everywhere.
I mean, even the earlier part, no one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. I mean, there you've already made it personal, and it's not just, oh, the environment is being destroyed, like that kind of song, that I find it very hard to take that kind of social commentary in a song, because seldom does that actually then become personal.
That's because they're shitty writers, people who write like that. It's because they don't understand how it works. They have something that they want to say to you, and they don't have the patience and the thoughtfulness to figure out how to make that work. They're just shitty writers. I don't know what else to say about it. You can't tell people what to think.
But music inherently, you can see this in movies a lot. Like, the soundtrack is telling you how to feel at this point. Like, it might be a shitty enough movie that actually it wouldn't be obvious before that. But like, they put on such a big lush, oh, this is a really touching moment. I'm not saying you're doing that. I'm not saying, but this is what I was referring to before, that you've got these very pretty acoustic country tropes that it almost doesn't matter how it reflects in your voice, how screwed up the character is. Like, it could just be a moderately, you know, this is sad that things are going this way. Or it could be, I'm about to shoot myself. This is so horrible. You can reflect that a little in your voice and how much you're going to, you know, how Leonard Cohen-esque you're going to get. But there's still just the nice lament that it's almost like the music is not so much an expression of the sorrow as it's a thing that we all know that when we get sad, we can sing a song. And so, you know, it's again, the kind of the blanket that is keeping it from being as bleak as it could possibly be. I don't know if you're familiar with like Syd Barrett's solo stuff from the guy from Pink Floyd. His bandmates didn't want him to even release that stuff because it's so, there is no blanket. It's just stark, like, what the hell is wrong with you? That even your most screwed up protagonists have a listenable thing that is kind of maybe the tone in which they think about their sorrow, as opposed to just being so sorrowful that you can't even articulate anything at all.
It's funny because writers write what they're drawn to. Good writers write what they're drawn to naturally and what they're interested in investigating. They're interested in, you know, the human experience and the nuances of it. And they're interested in characters and they're interested in language. Writers don't sit around thinking, like, what am I going to write about now? You just do it. You just get on with it.
I know some of this is from, you know, relating to your past experience and the work you did before becoming a musician and your family life. Do you find yourself having to research, or, you know, you're going around and talking to people, kind of farming them, whether consciously or not, but to make those stories more real, be able to tell a greater range of stories? Obviously, not all the stories are about you. Some are about women. Some are about little kids.
The answer to your question is it's less self-conscious than that, but my antenna is always up. And I think that that's another element of writing. If you're going to be a writer in any form of media, your antenna has to always be up. You have to always be taking things in. How do people say this in this particular area? Always listening to how people perceive things and how they relate things. It's one of the things that I just naturally do. I've been writing for so long. You're looking for details that make things come alive and details that make things real. It's interesting because, you know, there are a lot of books now about songwriting and there are a lot of instruction now. There are a lot of workshops that you can go to and things like that. And there weren't any of those things when I was a kid. You know, I certainly didn't have access to any of it. I just really paid a lot of attention to the songwriters that I loved or the songwriters that I found, you know, made that thing in my spine kind of tingle. Maybe not even a whole song, but like a line in a song that just felt really vivid and alive and truthful. You know, that's what I was always looking for in myself. That's what I was always looking for in other people's songs. I just slowly sort of trained my antenna to always be up and looking for those things.
You know, especially as you're getting into writing more short stories, I mean, I think that would be a place. I'm just thinking of it, like writers like John Irving, like Cider House Rules, very emotional books, very much kind of growing out of this same character study thing. But maybe if you just go on at length enough, then you better freaking research how exactly a cider house works, you know, or whatever the, you've got these details from sheetrocking or whatever the things you were familiar with. And you need to get a little of that, as you say, specific detail, or it just doesn't feel like it's a real picture. You know, you're making up something that's emotionally related to something that you have familiarity with. But that particular situation, I guess that's the big difficulty from getting from one's first book, which is very often a diary, more or less, you know, expanded. Some of it's autobiographical and some of it's not too full-blown literary fiction.
I agree with everything that you just said. And to bring it back to songwriting, I mean, you write what you know and you try to expand what you know so that you can write about other things. Of course, it's all subjective. During some of this interview, I've sounded a little bit pointed, but it's all subjective. It's all what moves you, you know, different things move different people.
And I noticed, you know, you're not writing a lot of I'm on the road again. How often do you tour a lot of the year?
I tour about 8 or 9 months out of the year. Yeah.
So given that that's your experience, if you were really writing what you know right now, then it would be a lot of perhaps kind of dull. This is what it's like to be in a hotel room after a show. But that's not the part of the experience that you're drawing on.
I just think that's not a very interesting, you know, it's been done.
Sure.
It's been done with a lot of manipulation, you know what I mean, about the romance of it. So when I do touch on those pieces, trying to think of a song, there's another song on the new record. There's a line, I washed my clothes out in the hotel sink and took something so I wouldn't have to think. That's a line that comes right out of my own life. But I don't do it much. Writing about being on the road, traveling around, writing songs has been done. It's been covered. It's not as romantic as people think it is, and I'm not interested in making any more lies.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the song. It's a Loudon Wainwright, you know, come on up to my motel room and save my life. That's like one of those Syd Barrett level, soul exposing, you know, about that. No need to do more of that. But you're not depressed by that activity, right? You're enjoying, as compared to sheetrocking, you've expressed in many interviews how grateful you are to be doing this.
Yeah, well, I vacillate back and forth. I mean, this is an incredibly hard lifestyle. You know, I won't lie. You spend months out on the road. It's a very unusual profession because in most jobs, you have sort of have colleagues and you have ongoing projects and you have things that you're dealing with from day to day. And sure, it changes over time, but you sort of have a job and you have your duties within that job and within that construct of whatever your job is. But this job feels very much like it completely starts over again every day. You go into a different club, you have a different audience, you have a different sound guy, you have a different owner, you're constantly dealing with these different personalities. It's a very strange job because it's incredibly exhausting. The hours are endless. And yet you never really work that hard. You know, I mean, the hardest I work is, I mean, the drive is harder than...
You able to write during the drives in the hotel rooms? You know, being able to take advantage of that time obviously kicks up your output. But I've heard just from a number of musicians that just find, as you're describing, that it's so draining that they kind of have to be during an off time, not touring, and go off and, you know, seclude themselves, and then they can actually write good stuff.
Yeah, you're right. People are very split on that. I happen to be in the camp of I can write anywhere. Like, as soon as we're done with this interview, I can start writing something. I can write backstage. I can write on an airplane. I keep a recorder in the car when I'm driving for ideas that I fill. I can write just about anywhere. It's not a bragging thing at all. It's just kind of how you're made. Because my favorite co-writer, Slade Cleaves, who I've written with since I was 25 years old, we've written together for 28 years, he's just the opposite. He needs to seclude himself. He needs to leave his phone at home and go to a cabin and be really quiet and like sort of to access that part of his mind. Even though we write so well together, we're exactly opposite on that particular issue. I can write anywhere and at any time. You know, 5 minutes before the show, sometimes I'm writing.
That's a good transition. Let's introduce the last song, which is another co-written one. You're Not Missing Anything from Hang Your Hopes on a Crooked Nail 2014. Give the intro to this and we'll say goodbye.
This is a good one to end on because I just talked about writing with Slade Cleaves. We fought bitterly over this song. He desperately wanted a bridge and I said, no bridge, absolutely no bridge. This was a song that I dreamed. I dreamed the chord sequence and melody, which is actually quite not a completely unusual chord sequence, but you'll hear how it starts on the minor and goes to another minor before it hits the major chorded. It's an unusual chord progression, or it's an unusual alignment of those chords within a common chord progression. Yeah, the song meant a lot to me. There was something about the melody, and Slade helped me a lot with the lyric. I was a bit lost initially. I had this piece of music, which is unusual for me. Like I said earlier in the interview, I feel like the best songs come from having a bit of each thing, you know, the lyric, chord progression and melody, a little bit of each of those things. But this one was just basically a piece of music that I dreamt and woke up in the middle of the night and sung into my recorder and grabbed the guitar and found the chords. And it's a song about regret. It's not a happy song. That's why I call the tour Rod Picott Circus of Misery and Heartbreak.
Well, this is definitely one of my favorite. And I like the fact that you've got a little different palette with this one, with the arrangement that you've got mandolins in there. Your voice is doing yet another thing that we haven't heard yet in any of these previous three songs. I've written Tom Petty-ish.
It's a little more musical. The palette is a little more colorful on this one. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, thanks so much for talking. It's been really great reading. I want to really recommend folks to get the book. You don't have to read them together. It's not the libretto or something. But yes, it really, really helps you focus in on what you are as a writer. That I don't know that if I just heard individual things, again, it's nice enough sounding music. I don't know if I would have necessarily been as acutely aware of what stories you were trying to tell if I was just hearing these very nicely produced recordings. But I guess if you're coming to see you live, like, that's what it is. It's in your face telling the story. That's the show.
That's the show. Yeah. And if you're not afraid of the dark, the book will be okay. If you're afraid of the dark, the book might not be for you. Thank you so much for having me on here, Mark. I appreciate the time very much.
Mm-hmm. velvet cups here beside the bed. I made too much again. Sometimes I forget you left some things. I'll just keep them here. I've got a little place for souvenirs. In the dead of night, I still reach for you. So warm, the bed sheets are cool, and so it goes. Just another end. Turn around and start all over again. You're not missing anything, baby.
Thanks so much to Rod, a super impressive guy. I encourage you to pick up the new album as well as the short stories. My next interview will be with Lindsay Murray, discussing her ongoing recording project, Gretchen's Wheel. As usual, I have plenty more in the hopper after that already, including most recently an interview with Grammy-nominated songwriter Seth Swirsky, who, among many other things, wrote Al Green's last hit, Love is a Beautiful Thing. It's been used on many soundtracks and redone many times. Also, as always, I want to encourage you to contribute to this project. Help it continue to happen by going to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. And of course, please subscribe to the podcast. And it'd be nice if you could leave a nice rating or review on the iTunes store to help other folks discover us. I hope your summer is proceeding well. We're in the last couple weeks here at my house before I send my son off to college. So that is bittersweet, certainly. But I have done some songwriting recently, trying to get my band to learn a couple more newish songs before we go into the studio in late September. So may your creative endeavors flourish, may your life run smoothly, and be filled with delight. Keep on musicking. This is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.
You be my bunny, I'll be